I'd like to begin this morning by answering a few questions that came after the talk last night that I thought many of you might be interested in. So I'll take a few minutes here at the opening to do this. Basically, I had three questions. Two I'll answer this morning, one I'll answer tomorrow. If you have other things that come up, I'll be glad to go over them. One was simply the question of how early should you start teaching young people Shakespeare? When are they ready for it? Let me answer this in a couple of ways. We almost always underestimate how ready children are to begin to gather certain kinds of information. Best example that I know of is the very acquisition of language skills themselves. One thing that scientists have done that is of some value is that they have learned that children have this remarkable ability. It seems to be a part of the very brain, and as the brain is beginning to function, to learn any number of languages up until about the age of 5 or 6. They can just absorb any number of languages. I had always heard this, I found it a little odd, but my nephew, who is growing up in a bilingual home, I mean, I'm seeing it happen. My sister-in-law is French. She always speaks French to the children. My brother speaks English, and there's this little 3-year-old running around speaking two languages. I mean, I'm in the odd position of envying my 3-year-old nephew, who is gaining language skills that, you know, I began my study of French when I was about 16 years old, and it's just been trying to drill it in, and I never quite got it, and I have this hideous accent, and, you know, it's just, there's this little 3-year-old who is now speaking two languages simultaneously. For him, they're two words for everything. It's an amazing. Then they from about the age of 6 until 12, it shuts down a bit, but they can still absorb. They can still learn any number of languages, not as quickly, not as efficiently. And then we usually start teaching languages at about 12, when the whole process is shut down. It's simply craziness. Again, the children are much more able to receive these things than we understand. Now, much is true of that is true, I think, with great, the very best literature. You can, in a way, introduce even young children to Shakespeare by reading them Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare. The stories written up in the 19th century, Charles and Mary Lamb. And what it will simply do is familiarize them a bit with the stories. They'll get to know the stories a bit, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. My first introduction to Shakespeare came with those old classics illustrated comic books. I was a comic book fiend. Fortunately, back then, comic books were halfway decent. Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse. But I also would pick up these, Classics Illustrated. And I remember getting the Classics Illustrated comic book version of Hamlet. Now, I didn't, you know, what did I like? I liked the ghost and the sword fights. Okay, and I'd look at that a lot. Which was fine. Introduced me to the work. I began to get a sense of it. The artwork was actually pretty good. And then, the serious study began. When I was about 13 years old, and I guess my answer would be 12 or 13, I think is a good time to begin. I was in eighth grade, and God be praised, it was one of the handful of great teachers I had. I had her for 2 years, Catholic lady. I realize that now. At the time, it didn't mean much to me, other than we knew she was sort of weird. She was teaching in the public schools. We knew she was Catholic. She was one of those women that probably should have been a nun. All the attributes of a nun and all of those stories I've heard of people who were taught by nuns. She was tall, she was rigid, she was severe, she walked around with that ruler and we were in terror of her, okay? And she was magnificent. Her name was Marie Cal. She taught us grammar. She taught us to write. She taught us literature and God bless her, she gave me, because she knew I was a reader and reading junk, comic books, murder mysteries. One day she slipped me a Jules Verne novel and said, why don't you read this? You might like this. And it was like, whoa. Say, this is really, you got more of those things? At which point she changed my life by slipping me David Copperfield. And to this day, the great reading experience of my life, meeting Mr. Micawber and Peggotty and Barkas and going to, it changed my life. Changed my life. And then the second year, we did Shakespeare. Now, understand, this was a wise woman. She had taught for many years. We spent about 10 weeks on The Merchant of Venice. That may seem, it may seem unfathomable. She spent that amount of time. But she also gave it to us at the level in which we could take it in. What does that mean? The first thing you do is you help them read it. You just go through it slowly. Today we're going to do this scene. What do these words, some of these words mean? Not intricate, elaborate discussion, just what's going on? What's happening here? How do we know what's happening here? That was followed by intensive memorization. The best thing you can do for young people, even if you do nothing else, get them to read the play and make them memorize the great speeches, and they'll do it. And they'll do it. Again, at that age, they can memorize. I try to remember things now. The brain is Swiss cheese. It flows out. But to this day, I can do the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath it is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes his mightiest in the mightiest. And I thank Marie Cal for it. She made us memorize about a third of the play. And that's lodged up here. I carry it with me. Make them memorize. Let them act out little scenes. It's very simple. The girls will like the love scenes. The boys will like the action scenes. It's as simple as that, which is fine. You know, play to their strengths. Give them what they like. You know, if you've got them playing different roles, it doesn't matter. You know, if you've got if girls playing the boys playing the girls at that age, it doesn't matter. Okay? It's still the experience of letting them act it out a bit, and they'll remember it if they act it out a bit. They can mangle the language, they cannot understand a lot, they'll understand enough of it, and it will stick, and it will become familiar to them. It will become a friend to them. Then she made us, and this was wonderful, we had to do plot diagrams. This is a woman who made us diagram sentences week after week after week. It's one reason I know grammar. It's never left me. We'd be at the board diagramming sentences. We diagrammed everything. She made us diagram the plots. There are three plots in Merchant of Venice. The bond plot, Shylock lends money to Bassanio. The casket plot, Portia's father has set up this contest where her suitor, the one who's going to marry her, has to choose the right little box. And the one who chooses the right box gets to marry the daughter. And the ring plot, the exchanging of the rings and where they go. Well, there were three plots. We had to diagram them. Where does it start? Where do they intersect? Okay. And we had these big sheets of paper. We're on the floor trying to figure this out. It was a wonderful exercise. And what I took away from it was dawning on me how skillfully that play was constructed. That's what we did with Merchant of Venice. We did not get into deep analysis. It wasn't until years later I went back to it. It was like meeting an old friend, but suddenly it opened up to me and I began to see the... But she hadn't done that with us. She had taken us through the play so we got to know the play. It wasn't foreign. She saw I was fascinated by it. She encouraged me to read more. For Christmas that year, my parents said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want Shakespeare plays." They were like, "Oh, well..." And they were very kind. They went to the little bookstore downtown and they asked her what to get, and she said, don't get a big one, get some of the little and that he can read, you know, just hold and read like a little book. And they got a number of them and wrapped them. I knew they were under the Christmas tree, and to this day I remember the days before Christmas holding them up to the lights, trying to see which ones I was getting. Never got more exciting gifts in my life than those little gifts. I remember opening them at Christmas, and the first one I opened and the next one I read was The Tempest. And it was just, wow, this is strange and wonderful. Didn't understand a bit of it, but liked Caliban, the weird fish man monster, and you know, just loved the thing. Didn't know it, but she did for me the best thing that a teacher can do. She taught me to love that stuff. Before I understood it, I loved it. We love first. You have to know in order to love, but know can mean being introduced. Then you come to love, and then you can spend a lifetime exploring. And it was a great gift she gave me. And I was fortunate enough to have good parents who went out and assisted, even though they didn't understand a bit of it. They were there to encourage me. If you would please remember my poor Protestant parents in your prayers. I love them deeply. They did much for me. They're sunk in Protestantism. I would appreciate it if you would remember my parents in your prayers. Marie Cal has gone to her rest. God rest her soul. She was a good Catholic woman. And she gave me my vocation. And she retired early. She couldn't stand it anymore. The kids had gotten out of control, and the administration wouldn't support her, and she quit. And that's how the great teachers fell. It's very interesting. I've been told by my chairman that I shouldn't be teaching The Merchant of Venice. I got in a real battle about 2 years ago. I had a student who came to me, a young woman, who was being forced to read Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, an obscene book, for class. She had read about the first 30, 40 pages, came to me in tears and said, "I can't read this. This is so vile. It's doing something awful to my imagination. We're required to read it for class. What do I do?" I said, "Close it, never open it again. Don't read it." She said, "What will happen?" I said, "I flunked the course. Doesn't matter. Flunking the course is of less importance than having your imagination soiled in that way." Well, needless to say, the other professor who had assigned the book came at me like a rabid beast. The chairman had to intervene. I got this call from the chairman. "Did you tell a student not to read a book assigned in a course?" I said, "Yeah, that's right, yeah." And I'll stand by that. "Why did you?" I said, because the book is obscene and should not be read. "Well, I think The Merchant of Venice is obscene and shouldn't be taught." I said, "Well, you're wrong about that." Well, it's just, you know, and it went on from there. in any case, ages 12 or 13, but don't get them into heavy analysis. Not necessary. Help them through the story. Give them little swords and let them whack at each other as they yell a couple of the lines. Get them to memorize. Get them to memorize the great speeches. They will have them for a lifetime. And it will be well worth the trouble. The other question I'll answer tomorrow. Sort of which films are worth watching? Which plays to look at? I will go through all of that tomorrow. It is an important question. Here's what I would like to do now. let me tell you the reason I'm concentrating this morning on Romeo and Juliet, aside from the fact that it's a great play. One of the top 10 money-making films in America right now is called Shakespeare in Love. It's out there. You're going to be hearing about it. Needless to say, I went to see it, bought my popcorn, stayed to the end. It filled me with great sorrow. Here is the problem. The people who made that film had within their grasp one of the most magical comedies ever written. It is an absolute delight in many ways. We get a vision of the young playwright. We get a vision of him struggling to figure out how to write plays. It is the best vision I've ever seen of Elizabethan London and what the theater life was like and what the audiences were like. There are magical moments in it as he meets a beautiful upper-class woman and falls in love with her, okay? But it is destroyed by scenes of impurity. Destroyed. And it broke my heart. I wanted to go up into the projection booth with a scissors and just snip out those moments. They are not necessary. They besmirch the beauty and charm and delicacy and wit and comic effect of the film. But it seems that, and it's not surprising, you can't get a film made now without scenes of impurity. It seems to be essential. They won't put up the money unless there's going to be filth involved. Heartbreaking. And the film has an R rating, which means all those young people who could have, if they'd removed all of that, if they'd kept the relationship, Shakespeare, and it is said, and I'll get to this in a moment, had a wife at home in Stratford, doesn't mean his heart couldn't have gone out in a pure way to another young woman, and he could have been inspired by her. Okay? It didn't happen. We know it didn't happen. It's a construct, but and she inspired him to write this beautiful poetry. There would have been nothing wrong. It would have been lifelike in its way. Now, they besmirched it. They destroyed it. I can't recommend it. I have to tell people not to go see it. And it's a shame. But it raised the question, and it's a perfect example of how we take an idea, a very important idea, purity and chastity, and how Shakespeare treats it, and how the modern world treats it. And in this case, it's in a film that deals with Shakespeare as the subject matter, and what's going on throughout the film, he's trying to write Romeo and Juliet. That's why I've come back to this play, and I want to spend some time this morning talking about the play, because this play is a perfect example of how Shakespeare in one sense is modern and in another sense is medieval, and how the medieval triumphs. And in order to understand Shakespeare and why Shakespeare can be of great use to the modern world and the modern mind, we have to take what's actually there as opposed to what the modern world may tell us is there. Now, why is it a subject of some importance? Here it is. This is a biographical fact I didn't get into yesterday. Shakespeare married a woman named Anne Hathaway. They were they were married on November 27th, 1582. The banns were read only once, not the customary three times. It was a hurry-up job. The reason it was a hurry-up job is because the first child, Susanna, was born May 26, 1583. Okay, we can do it. 6 months later. The woman was 8 years older than Shakespeare. We don't know what went on, other than with the birth of the child. We know certain basic natural things went on. But there is a moment in Twelfth Night where there's a wonderful line where a character says, "Let the man take a wife younger than himself." It's always struck me as maybe a little hard-learned lesson there. Okay? It must have been in some ways a difficult marriage because she stayed with the family in Stratford. He was in London doing the plays. In one sense, he had to make money for the family. This was his talent. This is what he did. He did it well, and we're lucky to have the plays. The wife was at home with the children, but there was distance between them. We don't know much about the marriage. We shouldn't speculate. But we do know from the sonnets, great love poems, a couple of things that went on. When Shakespeare was in London, he became aware of different kinds of love. The bulk of the sonnets, the most beautiful love poems in the language, were written to a young man. It's the second question I always get after, did he really write these plays? Yes, he wrote the plays. I go through all that. Next question. Was he really gay? No, he wasn't. This is the modern world besmirching the name again. Well, then why do you write poems to a guy? Because there is such a thing as passionate friendship that can partake of love, can help us understand love, and at the time, the love of friends, man for man, woman for woman, was considered higher than male-female love, precisely because it was non-physical. It was indeed an intense and passionate love between two people that did not move toward the physical and hence was a higher love, as is love of parent for child, friend for friend, all of this leading towards the highest love. This is, of course, a Platonic notion that there is the ladder of love and some loves are higher, leading toward the ultimate love of God, the love of the soul for God, hence a higher love. Hence the beauty of these love poems. Was it, well, how can you call it love? You know, and then I get them to admit they have friends that they care very deeply for and are close to that have meant a lot to them. You know, do you love that? Well, is it love? Okay. Would you consider doing a, oh, no. Okay. You can work it out of them, but what the world has taught them is to immediately go to the base. Okay. Make the basest assumptions. Things that they would not assume in their own life, in their own relationships. You got to clear that up. Point being, he learned a high love from this love for a close friend. Young nobleman, we don't know the circumstances. I could speak at length about it, but it's another question. But we do know he had an adulterous affair with the dark lady. We have 28 sonnets, and we know it tormented him. He knew it was wrong. He knew he should stop it. It's clear that he eventually did stop it. It's clear that he broke away from her. But in the course of it, as he wrote these sonnets, he was trapped in something, in a physical relationship that was deadly. And not just deadly in terms of what it was doing to his conscience. He knew it was killing his soul. The great poem in the English language about lust is Sonnet 129. Make young people memorize it. Make them learn it early on. It is a painful but brutally honest poem. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. And till action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, enjoyed no sooner, but despised straight. Past reason hunted, and no sooner had, past reason hated, as a swallowed bait, on purpose laid to make the taker mad. Mad in pursuit and in possession so. Had, having, and in quest to have, extreme. A bliss in proof, but proved a very woe. Before, a joy proposed, behind, a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. He was in the midst of something, he knew it, and it begins with that abstract notion of the expense of spirit and a waste of shame, which, by the way, is a bawdy pun. Spirit meant semen, waste meant physical waste. You have a high abstract idea and at the same time a bawdy pun describing it as a mere physical action. And by the end we have something that can be, to shun the heaven, he'll admit it's fun, it's attractive, to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. And the recognition not just of the hellish endurance of trying to live in a situation of knowing he was doing wrong with the wife and family, but also the spiritual recognition of, you continue this, that's where you will be led. That's where you will end up. And that word has a very specific theological meaning. And it's this hell. That's where he is. Soul separated from God in torment. Strong stuff. There are many of the other poems, 142, 147, 151, just over and over again in those poems. He's been destroyed by this, eaten up by this. Now, at the beginning of this movie that they make, They slander Shakespeare by suggesting he's sleeping around with all sorts of women. It could not be the case. From this one affair, he's tortured. And it's clear it stopped at some point. He finally freed himself. And from that point on, there's no record of anything other than his work. And he becomes a rather quiet, modest man. But at the time he is writing Romeo and Juliet, he is aware of a difference between a higher love, a spiritual love, a proper love, and mere physical appetite, mere lust that masquerades as love and is not love. And in the play, he is examining those two kinds of love. A modern reading of Romeo and Juliet will give you the play very simply. There are these two young kids, and they're just adorable, and they fall in love, and their parents are just terrible, and therefore they have to go around their parents, and because of circumstances, star-crossed lovers, all of these accidents occur, and they both end up dead, and gee, that's so sad, and we cry a lot. That's the modern reading. I must say, Franco Zeffirelli, one of my favorite film directors, made my favorite Shakespeare film, The Taming of the Shrew, made a pretty good Hamlet. I'll talk about that tomorrow, the one with Mel Gibson. His Romeo and Juliet is okay, but boy, it tends towards that. The kids are just, you know, beautiful, and you just have a good cry at the end. It's not the play in its fullness. What's the play in its fullness? Let me give you some of the complexities from a Catholic point of view and why the play is Catholic through and through and can be used to hammer Catholic doctrine over a modern young person's head, even if that person sitting innocently in a class at the Naval Academy doesn't know he or she's being fed Catholic doctrine. Act 1, Scene 1, we have a situation in the city of Verona where the city is coming apart. The city itself is chaotic. The point I'm going to make all the way through this is not a play in which the heavens have just decreed that it's all going to end unhappily. Romeo may call out, "Oh, I am fortune's fool," but fortune isn't what's driving things here. The stars are not driving things here. All the way through Shakespeare, characters keep saying, "Oh, it's the stars, it's the stars." And more sensible characters say, "Nonsense, it's you." Okay. Famous lines from Julius Caesar. Okay. "The fault, dear Brutus, okay, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." Okay. Now, Cassius goes on to get it wrong, that we are underlings, and then says it's Caesar's fault. You know, but still, the notion is there. It's not the stars. Edmund and King Lear. This is the excellent foppery of the world. We blame the stars for things we do ourselves. Okay, that's everywhere. It's in this play. It's in this play. And from the beginning, begins with that combat on the streets of Verona. The Capulet family, the Montague family, they're fighting again. The prince comes in and says, "What are you doing? Rebellious subjects, enemies to peace. Profaners of this neighbor's stained steel, will they not hear? Stop them, part them." And then he says something extraordinary. It's a great speech. And then he suddenly says, "Three civil brawls, bred of an airy wood, by thee, old Capulet and Montague, have thrice disturbed the quiet of our streets and made Verona's ancient citizens cast by their grave beseeming ornaments to wield old partisans in hands of old." You've got the old people out in the streets fighting, not just the young guys. Everybody's fighting in the streets. And you know what? "You've done it three times," says the prince. "Excuse me, prince. Why didn't you stop it after the first time?" And in fact, he says, "You, Capulet, shall go along with me and Montague, come to this. If ever you disturb our streets again, if you do it a fourth time, I'm going to get really mad." From the beginning of the play, there is a problem with authority in the city. "You've done this three times. I'm not going to let you do it again. Or if you do it again now, then I'll just shake my jowls and stomp my feet and really have a hissy fit." Well, who's running the show? Who's in charge of the city? From the beginning, there's a problem. And indeed, the problem goes from prince to parents. It is a city filled with anger and violence. And the young people are doing nothing other than hanging around the square and fighting each other or falling in love meaninglessly. These people don't have enough to do. Nobody works in this place. Nobody. It is a vision. It is a vision of the problem of too much leisure time. Nobody's working. It's a wealthy city. And this is what it's descended to. Now, Romeo is one of them. He's not the fighter at first. He's just lolling around, falling in love. He's fallen in love with Rosaline. He's very upset because she's announced she's going to be chased her whole life. Well, God bless her. We never meet her. We only hear about her. And he's moping because she's made this decision. And he's going on about how much he loves her. Act 1, scene 1, line about 177. The language is pathetic. Shakespeare had to work to deliberately write words this bad. Oh, heavy lightness, serious vanity, misshapen chaos of well-seeming forms, feather of lead, bright smoke, cold fire, sick health, still waking sleep that is not what it is, this love feel I that feel no love in this. He is spouting every cliche of the poetry of the day, stuff that had been done to death. If he was a bad rock musician today, he'd be echoing all the lyrics that had already been done 40 years ago by Dylan. It's just sort of... Okay. Oh, my heart's blowing in the wind like a rolling stone because I'm all sad. You know, the language is appallingly bad and it's deliberate. But language is a measure of character. This kid is empty. Empty. There's nothing there. He thinks he's in love. And he's complaining because his love isn't returned. Why? Because the woman wants to remain chaste. It's very clear. Good for her. And she's telling him that, obviously, simply because she apparently has some character. We never meet her. Shakespeare creates interesting characters, even off stage, we never meet. She's having nothing to do with this little twerp. Nothing at all. Now, I'm going to take a few minutes here, even though I don't have a lot of minutes. Mercutio and his other friends say, come on, let's go to the ball tonight. What ball? The Capulets are having a ball. Oh, we shouldn't show up there. We're Montague men. That would be in trouble. We'll disguise ourselves. We'll go there. Okay, and they crash the party. And they're there to have a good time, and they're, you know, everybody's dancing, and they're drinking too much. And then he sees a beauty that transforms him. And when he sees Juliet for the first time, what comes out of his mouth? One of the greatest lines of poetry ever written. The instant he sees her, his language changes, which tells us there has been a change of heart and soul. The party is lit by torchlight. They didn't have electric lights. He sees her and says, oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. First words out of his mouth when he sees Julia. Now, let's go through. It's a poetic line. It's iambic pentameter, okay? 5 feet in the line. The basic pulse, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. There it is. It's iambic rhythm, 5 feet. End of line. Poetry is rigid. Poetry has rules. You've got to follow them. But here he breaks the rules a bit. That's our basic pulse, but that's not the rhythm of the line, in that the line begins with what's called a spondi, not an iamb. Not short, long, but two long, accented, heavy syllables. Oh, she. I love it that the first thing that comes out of Romeo's mouth when he sees Juliet is, Whoa! It's like he's been punched in the gut. It's not even a word. It's just this exhalation of breath. Oh! And the second word is almost caveman-like. She! So now we've identified the reaction and what caused it, okay? Oh, she. But that's where we begin, but it's instantly transformed. And please notice, this is Shakespeare at his best. The first thing that Romeo says about Juliet is that she is a teacher. That she is going to teach the very torches here lighting this ballroom how to burn more brightly. She's brighter than the flames and the torches. She'll teach them, and indeed, she teaches this young punk about love. That's precisely what she does from the beginning to the end of the play. She is a good Catholic girl, and what she does is teach about the real meaning of love. I'll give some examples of that in a moment. Doth teach the torches to burn bright. Variation in rhythms. We have a little Pyrrhic foot there, two unaccented syllables. The line ends with the spondee, double accent. But what do we know, of course, about a torch that burns bright? There's more heat, there's more light, it's going to go out more quickly. And as a result, that's exactly what this love is going to be. Bright, quick, intense, and then gone. Please notice as well, just in terms of stage properties and what's going on in stage, where does he first see Juliet? By torchlight. Where does he last see Juliet? By torchlight in the tomb. He comes in carrying a torch and recognizes the body by torchlight. The torch when he first sees her, the torch when he last sees her, and the image of the torch in the line of poetry he utters. And you know, it's one of those moments you say, how did he do that? My students always say, did he plan all that? I'll say he was turning out three of these a year. He couldn't have planned it. It's the mystery of genius. It's all there. It was a gift. It was a gift. It used to be the notion of the muse would inspire. Great talent, great genius is a gift from God. God inspired him. He put it down. What do we know about Shakespeare? The one account of him writing, he never blotted out a line. He didn't make corrections. It's just amazing. We have someone who saw him writing, who said, Master Shakespeare, complaining to Ben Jonson, who rewrote and rewrote and worked. And the comment was, Master Shakespeare never blotted out a line. And Ben Jonson's response, what, he had blotted 1,000? They were friends, but Jonson, it was all too messy. He just puts it down. Now, she's the teacher. This torch will burn bright. But look at the sounds here. And the sounds divide in two parts. Oh, she doth teach the torches. Shh. 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 Romeo's going all soft and mushy. It's happening. There's a sense of and it's there. It's there. We get the sounds that connect. Poetry, again, is the connection of sounds in order to make a point. But by the end of the line, he's manly again, but what's happening is not just the, oh, whoa, whoa, look at that beautiful woman. There's something else, and I love this. Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. And all of a sudden we get these R sounds entering the line. Three of them. With, t, t, b, b. And we hear a little animal growling in there. The passion is rising up. Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. He's a male, after all. There's no getting around him. He has been shaken by a vision of beauty. She is a female. He's still a man. There's a little hint of it. And when he goes to visit her at night during the famous balcony scene, gorgeous poetry comes out of him. Extraordinary poetry. He is not speaking the same language. Something has happened. Something has changed. Example. He sees her at the balcony. She sighs, eye me. He says she speaks. Oh, speak again, bright angel. For thou art as glorious to this night, being o'er my head, as is a winged messenger of heaven under the white upturned wondering eyes of mortals that fall back to gaze on him when he bestrides the lazy puffing clouds and sails upon the bosom of the air. He's seeing it. She's like an angel. And his reaction is like seeing one of God's messengers floating in on a cloud. The beauty is angelic, but the soul is angelic as well. The magnificent poetry back and forth. She has fallen in love with him. They have met. By the way, I don't have time to go over the sonnet. When they meet and finally speak to each other, it's in terms of making a pilgrimage, meeting at a shrine, and the pilgrim kissing the shrine. But of course, Romeo wants to kiss her lips, and she allows him one kiss. But as they speak it, they form a perfect sonnet. Order. Perfect order. Perfect dignity. Perfect restraint. The sonnet is all about restraint. 14 lines of unrhymed iambic pentameter. It's about passion, but ordered passion. It's not easy to write a sonnet, much less speak one spontaneously when you first meet someone. It's a little trick on Shakespeare's part, but we understand what he's getting at. At the end of the... They're about to make their goodbyes, and Romeo starts to swear. If my heart's dear love, she says, well, do not swear. I love it. I know what men's oaths are worth. I wasn't born yesterday. Although I joy in thee, I have no joy of this contract tonight. I'm delighted in you. I like you. But it is too rash, too unadvised, too sudden, too like the lightning, which doth cease to be ere one can say it lightens. Sweet, good night. This bud of love, by summer's ripening breath, may prove a beauteous flower when next we meet. It's wonderful. I love you, but this is a bud of love. We don't know where it's going. Patience, kid. This may just be a flash of lightning, okay? Just and gone. We don't know. But it may prove a beauteous flower when next we meet. Good night, as sweet repose and rest come to thy heart as that within my breast. And Romeo is a typical male pig. His next line, oh, wilt thou leave me so unsatisfied? It's what I mean. Shakespeare understands human nature perfectly. Her response, and I love this, what satisfaction canst thou have tonight? She's right back at him. The exchange of love of thy love's faithful vow for mine. I gave thee mine before thou didst request it. Get out of here. It's absolutely magnificent. But please notice what's happening. An insistence on the purity of the relationship. He keeps whining, and finally she responds in this way. Three words, dear Romeo, and good night indeed. Okay, just a couple more words and you're out of here. If that thy bent of love be honorable, thy purpose marriage, send me word tomorrow by one that I'll procure to come to thee, where and what time thou wilt perform the rite, and all my fortunes at thy foot I'll lay and follow thee, my lord, throughout the world. This is really love, if you mean it, and I feel deeply for you. Then, if you're honorable, if you propose marriage, if you're willing to marry me, then I will be your love. Okay? But again, it shows the quality of the young woman and what happens. Romeo runs right to Friar Lawrence. Right to Friar Lawrence. Great part. Great role. I'm too old to do Romeo, but boy, I'd love to do Friar Lawrence someday. Friar Lawrence, we meet him, he's gathering herbs. It's just great. Little lesson, he's talking about everything on earth, nothing so vile on earth that doth live, but to the earth some special good doth give. Nor aught so good, but strained from that fair use, revolts from true birth, stumbling on abuse. Virtue itself turns vice, being misapplied. But vice, sometimes, by action dignified. Wonderful. Wonderful. There is nothing so good that it cannot fall. There is nothing so low that it cannot, by a good action, lift itself up. That's Catholic. You think of all the Protestant doctrine that was hovering around at that time? That is plainly Catholic. And goes right to the core of the notion of sort of faith versus good works. Very fascinating. You get the exact same idea in Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag in a central passage. Great art repeats the eternal truths in different ways over time. Where he talks about the problem with every revolution in the world is that they have sought to get rid of the evil that they see in the world, but their error is they believe evil to exist outside of themselves. And they never understand, as Solzhenitsyn said, the dividing line between good and evil runs down the center of every human heart and is constantly shifting. Wonderful one. Same point here from Friar Lawrence. Romeo comes and says, I want to be married, And Friar Lawrence says to Rosaline, no, forget her. And the friar in his wisdom says, slow down, wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast. But he understands he has a unique case here. Now, were this a piece of piety rather than a great work of art, the friar would save the day. We meet him. He's a wise man. He's a good man. He knows what to do. He gives excellent advice. The moment comes, he makes a choice. The point I've been making all the way through. Everything that happens in this play is a human choice, and the friar makes a bad choice. He makes, curiously, the same mistake that the prince has made. The men in authority will not stand up to these two families. The friar's obligation, clearly, at this moment in the play, is to take the two kids, get the Montagues and the Capulets together, sit down the fathers and say, now, God has ordained the young people from your two families have fallen in love. They are seeking marriage. I approve of that marriage. They have proven in various ways they are worthy of marriage. And this is what's going to happen, folks. He doesn't. He tries to manipulate and hide and keep it buried so nobody will know. And there's no reason for that other than his personal fear of these two powerful families. We get a human being in the play. A good man, but a good man curiously flawed, and he has given his own analysis out of his own mouth when we first meet him. And we can follow through the pattern. He's saying all the right things even as he marries them. These violent delights have violent ends, and in their triumph die like fire and powder, which as they kiss, consume. This love could be gunpowder. Okay? Come with me and we will make short work. For by your leaves, you shall not stay alone till Holy Church incorporate two in one. You're coming with me. I'm not leaving you here alone. I don't trust the two of you. Maybe a noble love. It may be a spiritual love. It may be a high love. I'm not leaving you alone. You will not be alone until Holy Church incorporate two in one. He's doing the right thing. He's doing it hidden, in private, not public. No one will know they're married. And because of that, what happens? Her father is arranging a marriage with Paris. She's desperate. How does she get out of it? Romeo, in attempting to stop the battle, the fight between Mercutio and Tybalt, steps between them and attempting to be a peacemaker. Mercutio is killed. Romeo loses his temper, kills Tybalt, Juliet's cousin. Now we've got a mess on our hands. All of this following the marriage. By the way, I don't have time to get into it. Mercutio, one of Shakespeare's great characters, and the nurse, another wonderful character, both give voice to the notion that love is merely physical passion. Mercutio making bawdy jokes all the way through the play until suddenly he's dead and understands there may be something more than the flesh or that the flesh is frail. Even as he's dying, he keeps his wit. What are you wounded? Well, tis not as wide as a church door. Okay. Not as deep as a well or wide as a church door, but ask for me tomorrow and you'll find me a grave man, he says. As he's dying, it's just extraordinary. At the same time, at the moment of death, he cries out, a plague of both your houses. A plague of both your houses. What have we got? A house divided against itself cannot stand, nor can a city. Verona, in one sense, is the hero of this play, and it's a city divided, and it's ripping itself to pieces. The prince is letting it. The friar has helped. Ooh, now he has a real mess. Julian says to him, what do I do? Romeo is banished. What do I do? I have to marry Paris. Does the friar go to her father and say, this girl is married? I married her. Right now her husband is banished. We've got to work this out. There's more blood on the streets. He says, I've got a potion. Now, it's a small thing. He knows the doctrine. He speaks it well. It's just a little hard to put it into action. And he's got a hobby horse. He's very proud of his mixing herbs together and making little medicines. And instead of trusting in the firm, hard law, he says, well, I'll make a little potion. And I'll arrange things. Here's what I'll make this potion. You take it. They'll think you're dead. We'll put you in the tomb. And then I'll get Romeo back, and the two of you can run off together. No. Wrong. Wrong. But that's what they do. And the thing moves toward its end, not by accident, not because the letter that the friar sends doesn't get to Romeo, so he doesn't realize that she's really just asleep. She's not really dead. It's because the friar, in his weakness, is allowing this to go on. Romeo comes back, finds Juliet in the tomb, thinks she's dead. He kills himself by taking the drug he has bought illegally from the apothecary. The apothecary makes a choice to sell an illegal drug to Romeo. There's a rule of law and absolutes that hangs over this play, and every time somebody breaks them, things get worse. That's Catholic. That's just purely Catholic. There is an objective order. There is an objective rule of law. God's law, civil law. Nobody enforces it. Nobody follows it. And things just get worse and worse and worse. Romeo dies. Juliet wakes up, finds Romeo dead, takes the dagger. But before that happens, in comes the friar, expecting she's going to spirit her away. Well, before, of course, Romeo's killed Paris meanwhile. He goes to his death with two murders on his conscience. The friar finds blood all around and dead bodies and is just thinking, well, I'll get Julie out of the tomb and everything will be fine, and says, I hear some noise. Lady, come from that nest of death, contagion, and unnatural sleep. He admits he's gone against nature. A greater power than we can contradict hath thwarted our intents. I intended something, and it's not, and a higher power is saying no. Come away. Thy husband in thy bosom there lies dead in Paris too. Come, I'll dispose of thee among a sisterhood of holy nuns. Come on, you can be a nun. She's in despair. She's there. Her husband's dead next to her. Stay not to question, for the watch is coming. Now follow my authority. Now I'll speak sternly to you and give you orders. Come, go, good Juliet. Another noise. I dare no longer stay, and he runs out. Why? Because they'll find him, and he knows he's responsible, and he'll have to confront the bloody results of his action. He leaves her alone, and what does she do? She kills herself. This is not a sentimental little ending. This is horrible. And the fact of the matter is, it ends in a double suicide. An Elizabethan audience watching Romeo and Juliet will know these two young people, beautiful and delightful, and trying to uphold spiritual love as much as they could, have committed suicide. They are damned. This is one of the most shocking things Shakespeare ever wrote. The modern world views it sentimental. Oh, they die there, isn't it? The Elizabethan audience is going, these are the only Christian characters in Shakespeare who deliberately commit suicide. Two exceptions, Othello, who is converted, but it doesn't hold, and reverts to his paganism. Poor Ophelia, who's mad, and the question is, did she know what she was doing? Answer, probably not. Lost her reason. These are the only, all the other suicides in Shakespeare are Romans. This is a deliberate and designed ending of shock and horror. And the audience, still being Catholic, would have recognized the profound horror and loss of the end of this play. To drive that home now is difficult, but it can be done. And I will tell you, part of the greatness of that recent film, which does make some changes to the text, it's set now. As a result, language doesn't matter. They are yammering through these things so fast you miss all the lines until Romeo and Juliet, and suddenly you hear all the poetry perfectly plainly. Love recreates language. You've got a situation, it's set in modern Florida, you've got real gang warfare, guns and blood and horror, it's, and the parents not only are fighting, they're obviously big, drug kingpins or something, very wealthy, they don't care a hoot about those two children. They don't care at all about the children. End of the play, they just take the bodies away, there's no reconciliation. It's like, well, they're gone. Let's get back to business. But the most shocking thing, and the director gets a measure of the horror back in the ending of the play. Romeo dies. He cuts out the friar altogether. The friar's sort of a kind of Vatican II priest, I'll tell you. He's got a whole laboratory. He's got tattoos all over him. And he just vanishes. He just vanishes. He's not even part of the ending of the play. Juliet wakes up and takes a gun and blows her brains out. Those little teenage girls sitting there because they went to see Leonardo DiCaprio play Romeo, and who are sort of, oh, Romeo, oh, he died. All of a sudden, just, it's horrible. And maybe the director couldn't get the theological shock back in, but he gives a profound shock, and the audience has left that, not just sort of like, oh, do we have a good cry? Wasn't that sad? It's with this sense of horror. It's not a nice, pretty little death. But that's the ending of the play. And then the friar comes in, the prince comes in, and they finally do what they should have done all along. The friar has about a 50-line speech where he finally has to explain everything. He makes a public confession. The pain of He's doing what he should have done and ends by saying, all this I know, and to the marriage her nurse is privy, and if aught in this miscarried by my fault, let my old life be sacrificed some hour before his time unto the rigor of severest law. Whew. The prince responds, we still have known thee for a holy man. The prince forgives him. And the prince finally lays down the law and says, that's it. Look what you've done. And makes the families come together. And there's this sense of healing, but this horrible loss. It is a powerful and profound play. It is not a sentimental little tearjerker. But you can only comprehend its artistic complexity, the complexity of the ideas dealing with love and authority and death, if you are Catholic. And if you take it from a Catholic perspective, it's what I meant yesterday by saying the plays are the best proof that Shakespeare was a Catholic. Because this play doesn't work unless you accept Catholic doctrine. And once you do, whoa, it's 10 times as powerful. And young people need to know that. It becomes a more powerful play. The prince ends the play, a glooming peace this morning with it brings. The sun, for sorrow, will not show his head. Go hence to have more talk of these sad things. Some shall be pardoned, and some punished. For never was a story of more woe than this of Juliet and her Romeo. Magnificent ending. Worthy of the play. Order has been restored. What is the price? Unbelievable sacrifice. Unnecessary sacrifice. The blood in the tomb, and we end in the bloody tomb. Why was it necessary? Because of the sins, evasions, and failings of everyone in the play. And the bad choices that they made all along the way, from top to bottom. To end on a light note, stage production, this actually happened. The prince comes out at the end, gives his speech, and ends the couplet by saying, "For never was a story of more woe than this of Romeo and of her Julio." I just stood there, and the audience going, "Wow!" And the lights go down. It's the peril of live performance when you don't know what's going to come out of your mouth. what I will do tomorrow is a quick survey of the entire career, so, because there is a pattern to the career itself that is mysterious and informative, and then look at some specific plays that I think are particularly important, and I'll give you a rundown of available films in terms of what can be viewed that is worth the viewing. I've used this one play as a kind of example. Modern reading, medieval Catholic reading. And as Catholics, we have an obligation to uphold Shakespeare's intention as the modern world tries to turn him into cotton candy and intellectual mush. Okay? Thank you. Thank you. I will take questions. Be glad to take questions. There's... Yes? Yeah. Right. Good question. Let me put it this way. You don't see the blood. The gun is raised, you hear the firing, okay, and you see the corpse. You don't see the gore, okay? A decision the director made that was a good one, I think. Okay, so you know it happens, but you don't witness it. But it is a powerful end. But let me say this, and this is very important. You have to judge these things exactly as you suggested. For the Greeks, whose myths were often bloody and violent, no violence ever took place on the stage. The word obscene, as you know, comes from the Greek, and it means literally off stage, away from the scene. Obscene means off stage, those things that are not fit viewing. Okay? And as a result, for the Greeks, even the smallest hint would be overpowering. For a sheltered young person, yes, you have to be very careful what they see. They can handle a little bit of it, and they need to know about such things, but one needs to indeed put the damper on. For my students who have grown up awash in blood, it is almost impossible to shock them. Almost impossible to shock them. They find ideas shocking. For example, when I teach Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, I don't know if you know the play, it's magnificent. Again, you have a situation, the ruler has not enforced the laws, he just steps down, puts a rigid man in his place, enforces them absolutely, condemns to death a young man who has gotten his fiancée pregnant before they're actually married, condemns him to a situation Shakespeare would have understood, condemns him to death for jumping the gun, even though they were about to be married, and then the young man's sister, a novice nun, comes to him, he falls for her and says, "Okay, I'll let your brother live if you'll sleep with me." Just this awful circumstance and situation. Now, my students, when I teach the play, say to me, "So what's the big deal? I mean, why is she upset? She sleeps with the guy, her brother lives. What's the problem here?" So I have to start explaining to them, look, there is a problem here. She's a novice nun. There's this concept called mortal sin. Now, I'm going through the whole thing to explain. They start going, "Wow, this is weird." And then I always end it, and I do this deliberately. I say, "Well, look, let me put it this way. Any sex outside of marriage is a mortal sin. You are condemning your soul to hell, and when you stand before the judgment seat, God will condemn you to hell for eternity. And I see them starting going, what? And then I say, and you must forgive me because I just told you. So when you stand before God now, you can't say, I don't know, no one ever told me. And then they go... I have had students stomp out of class and never speak to me again. Never speak to me again. That's the most shocking class I do. Blood doesn't shock them. That shocks them, okay? If I were to say that to a young Catholic homeschooled child, they would just nod their head. So the shock value depends, you're quite right, on what they have been initiated into, what they understand. And one reserves shock for necessary moments. I would say even good young homeschooled children need to have some awareness of what's... Because they're going to, of necessity, go out into that world at some point. And it's a bloody world now. It's a violent world. One does that with taste and tact. Yes. And again, it's why one previews anything before showing it. Always, always. And makes a reasonable decision as to whether the benefit would outweigh what could be a considerable risk. And one makes a reasoned decision along those lines. And it very much depends on the audience. Yeah. But that's a decision you have to make. Yes. Yes. Other questions? Yes.
There's a lot of people comment that Shakespeare's body, and that's not, you know, the most, what was it in his day? What's the level of
bodiness?
Yep.
Let me.
In his day, was it body or was it normal?
Human nature has always been fallen. We've always been possessed of original sin. We know that people fell in ways that they have always fallen, but there was order, there was propriety, there were things that were not done, there was a real sense of shame. I'll get into this more tomorrow. There is a moment in his comedy, Much Ado About Nothing, where a young man is about to be married, betrothed to a young girl, and then through a plot, the villain attempts to break up the marriage by bringing the young man and showing him a young woman who he thinks is his fiancée, talking out at the window with another man the night before the wedding. It is so outrageous that the next day he breaks up the wedding, refuses to marry her. For the audience, that was perfectly appropriate. And gives you some sense of the order that we're talking about. That a young engaged woman the night before a wedding would speak out at the window with another man. I have trouble teaching that. It's like, what? You know, what is this? When Kenneth Branagh makes his film, they're not just speaking out at the window. And you've got this, the young hero has this vision of this, they're fully clothed, but clearly something naughty is going on, and the hero is devastated. That's pushing it. I think that was an appropriate decision, and it makes the rest of the film work. It's sadly necessary because we are so corrupt. There has clearly been a descent of corruption that is unbelievable. Unbelievable from that time to now. But let me put it this way. There is a kind of corruption that's taken place in the last 30 years that I can't believe. I turn on the radio now and hear on the news discussions of what the president of my country has done. I'm hearing things on the radio I didn't know about when I was in my 20s. And now it's coming over the airwaves and being discussed as if they're giving the stock market reports. You know, they're talking about pork bellies. I mean, it's just... So the sad thing is the corruption continues. They were human at that time, with human recognitions. You will find body talk. There's talk about it. Clearly people sinned, but there was a very real sense. And it came from the fact that England had been Catholic all those years. There was shame. There was right and wrong. There were things you did not do or did not speak about in public. And that's what we have lost. what we have lost. But then to a degree, that's the world I grew up in. As I said, huge stir in the 1950s when the word virgin was used in a movie for the first time. Just spoken. And now consider what you can go and see on the screen. Horrible. That's taken place in 40-some years. It's just there has been, as I'm fond of saying, one thing that the Second Vatican Council did was take the brakes off the car. The car was going downhill. It was to a degree out of control. And then the brakes went off the car. And I remember as a young Protestant at the time of the council, this notion that, hey, even the Catholic Church has finally given in. Let's boogie! You know, it's just, and that was the sense. Because that was the last bastion standing against all sorts of things. And then, and we knew it, it was, and suddenly it was that old Cole Porter song, Anything Goes. And that's what happened. That's what happened. And the decline, I mean, the brakes really are off the car. And we're getting near to the bottom, about to run into a brick wall. And the party just intensifies. So, as recently as 40, 50 years ago, there still was some degree of order. There were things you just would not have shown, talked about, done in public. Doesn't mean that mankind was not sinful.
Or doesn't mean that the body that, you know, is in there is something that people don't appropriate.
They were, let me put it this way, they were a society in love with language. And there was a kind of freedom in language, and they would talk about anything. But, you go back to Chaucer. I mean, people are now, there's this sense that Chaucer was bawdy. Chaucer had a sense of the fullness of human life and put it all in. Within the context of a clear moral order, there are things in Chaucer you would never find in Shakespeare. And Chaucer, overtly, openly Catholic, living in a Catholic society. They were not prudish. And you read the Miller's Tale and it's just, whoa. This was public entertainment? Yes, it was. And it was comic and was meant to show the absurdity of certain behavior. And he put it right, he put it down. But of course the Miller's Tale follows the Knight's Tale. We have had the moral order given to us, and then we see the opposite end. Then we see the lower animal end. And he would put it all down. Wasn't shamed or embarrassed. It is never vile or lascivious or pornographic. But there is a sense in which anyone who understands the fullness of human life should be able to talk about it to some degree with propriety, and in a proper context. It is American Puritanism that has created American pornography. It's always important to keep in mind the two sides of that coin are one. And as Catholics, we need not be prudish, but we must always be dignified. And always put things in proper context, with proper moral order and proper moral governance. Chaucer is much healthier. Shakespeare, when he's bawdy, is much healthier than any Puritan preacher. Because they are fully human in a proper Catholic context. And that's, again, it's an important thing to keep in mind, especially for those of us who are now trapped in the pornographic side of America. America run amok. Where the Puritanism is rising up now against smoking. You know, American Puritanism never dies, it just chooses different targets. And it went after alcohol earlier in the century, thank God I wasn't alive then. And now it's gone after tobacco. I mean, just, you know, it's insane. Absolutely insane. If we survive, we can be guaranteed that 20, 30 years from now, the amount of smoking going on will have tripled or quadrupled. Because for those who are young growing up, it's the only thing forbidden.
Ha 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 ha
Invest in tobacco stocks now. They're at record lows.